Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the Bike Radar podcast, brought to you from the team behind Cycling Plus, MBUK and BikeRadar.com. Hello there and welcome to the Bike Radar podcast. This is one of our tech Q&A sessions with Rob and Warren. So we've got Rob Weaver, he's our senior technical editor across all our titles. How are you doing today?
Yeah, good, thanks. Yeah, pleased I got that out on the bike yesterday as it's tipping down in rain today.
Classic British summertime, hey?
Yeah, Bristol Rainwatch, hashtag.
We've also got Warren Rossiter, who's our senior road technical editor. How's it going, Woz?
Yeah, very good, thanks, mate. Very good.
Excellent.
Yeah, like Rob, it's been a topsy-turvy week after 30 degrees all last week. So still getting out, just getting wet.
Good. Are you out on road or gravel? What you're riding at the moment, Woz?
This week is actually mainly road. I mean, last week was a bit more of a split, kind of half road, half gravel. Big week as well last week. It was like close to 400 miles from Monday to Friday. Not quite so many this week because... I'm giving up after a couple of hours of riding in the rain, as it were, rather than riding all day.
That's fair enough. Rob, what are you riding at the moment?
I can't tell you then. I spent 2 days riding. I spent a couple of days riding some stuff that's yet to be launched. So
nice.
Yeah, I don't want to get in trouble.
Yeah, I was riding something yesterday. I can't talk about it either. So safe to say, it's very nice.
I've been riding things I can now talk about as of yesterday. So I've been riding the new Yeti SB115, which I can talk about because it's gone live. So there we go.
You like it?
Yeah, no, I did. I mean, it's an interesting little bike. They've taken the SB100 XC race bike and kind of down-countryed it. So longer fork, longer stroke shock, and maybe a little few tweaks to the linkage. Yeah, they've done the suspension works real well. That Switch Infinity is pretty cool. Right then, well, we've got a load of questions that have come from our readers on social media. So we'll crack on. Some mountain bike questions, some road bike questions, but we'll start with the mountain bike one. So Rob, one of our readers is wondering, what's best for trail riding? XC shoes that look like roadie ones or downhill style flat shoes that take cleats?
Ooh, I would say... try and find a happy medium between the two. Mm-hmm. So the cross-country shoes would probably be, well, if you find the right pair, they can be pretty comfy. But Equally, they're likely to have either a really hard plastic or a carbon fiber sole, which is going to be pretty awkward to walk in. And, you know, if you're trail riding, chances are you will be scrambling up the odd hill from time to time and, you know, walking around cafes or pubs at the end of a ride. So while the XC style shoes are going to be super efficient, for power transfer and things like that, they will, you know, they do have their downsides. And on the flip side of that, obviously, the downhill style shoes, which generally take the form of, you know, like a skateboard style trainer, tend to have a bit more flex through the sole. They might be, they might have more protection and more padding on them to help protect your feet a bit better when riding downhill. And as a result, going to be heavier and less efficient to actually pedal in. So what I would say is try and find something that kind of sits in the middle. And there are some good examples. Shoes like the Shimano ME7. I know you're a big fan of that shoe in particular, which manages to sort of, it combines the two almost. So it's quite sleek. It has handy features like a lace flap, which means you're a little bit better protected in, you know, rain or puddle splashes and stuff like that. And the sole has just the right amount of flex around the toe and it will cut the hill nicely so you won't get any heel slip, so you can walk comfortably off the bike. Equally, it's stiff enough that it will be efficient when you're putting the power down. I guess the only downside really with that shoe is that it costs in the region of £180. So it's pretty pricey, but there are cheaper alternatives. Shimano do the AM7, which is probably a little more flexible than the ME7, but it's significantly cheaper. And then there's the likes of Specialized Clip Light. So that uses two bell dials and a little Velcro strap across the top. It costs £140, £145, I think. Again, it's a bit more given it than an XC shoe, but it is, yeah, that bit stiffer than a downhill, than the standard downhill shoe, and it's a little bit lighter as well. So great for sort of, you know, big all-day rides, high mileage, stuff like that, but equally you can wander around and you're not clipping and clopping and sliding here and there and everywhere when you walk on roots and rocks and stuff like that.
Cool. Yeah, I guess the other thing to sort of consider with all this is the pedals that you're using. If you've got like a SPD pedal without a cage around it at all, you know, more of an XC style pedal, then having that stiffer shoe is going to be beneficial because it needs a sort of, you know, your foot wants the support of that stiffer sole. Whereas if you've got a big, you know, platform around it, you can get away with those sort of more trail or towards a downhill orientated shoes, which maybe don't have the which have a bit more flex, so you want a bit more support. So
exactly,
maybe think about that as well. As you said, Rob, like the ME7 is, you know, my go-to trail shoe, but it is also very expensive. So there are cheaper options out there. As you said, I'm testing a few sub £100 trail shoes at the moment, and the names all have run away from me right now. But Shimano have, is it an ME3, I think it's called, which kind of looks a bit more XC, but does have sort of the flex and the comfort that I've sort of found from the ME7, with a few less features. There's no lace flap. It's a couple of Velcro and a boa. But that's, you know, like a nice little option. And Jira have a couple of reasonable options at that price point as well, sort of the £80 to £110 mark. So, I mean, those are RRPs. You know, we have to quote these. You can always shop around and maybe find a deal on them as well.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
Wicked. Okay, well, Warren, we're going to talk road tyres. Is there a puncture protective tyre, the likes of the Durano Gator Skin or Four Seasons, available in tubeless for a 700 by 25 mil road wheel?
Well, yes. I mean, first off, I'd say, you know, one of the best advantages of going tubeless is you've already got improved puncture protection over a standard clincher, especially when it comes to things like pinch punches. But if you are looking for a bit of extra protection, I'd probably say something like Schwalbe's One TLE, because that gets race guard protection. And it's a really great tyre. And it also comes in a really cool looking skin wall. Continental don't yet have any of their tougher tyres in tubeless. You know, they came a little bit late to the tubeless party, but the 5000 TL is a brilliant tyre. Hutchinson, they've got a couple of options. They've got the Intensive 2, which is built for kind of long distance durability, and the compound's got cut protection. And they've also got a Fusion 5 All Season, which is a year-round tyre. That's got hard skin reinforcement too. And then Michelin have got a new range of tubeless tyres, the Power Road TLR. That gets an aramid protection strip built into the, you know, to the running surface. But it's a really good question, because now I think the road tubeless market is really starting to mature. So I think we're going to see a few more All Seasons and tougher options pretty soon.
When I used to have like commuting tyres and stuff, you know, you get the, I had like a short marathon classic with the that Kevlar strip in it. It absolutely killed the ride quality. Is that still the case now these days, or are these, you know, the tyres with extra protection still ride a little bit rubbish? Or
no, it's come on a lot. You know, when I've seen, you know, things like a, you know, using an aramid strip rather than a reinforced casing, you know, rolling resistance has improved a lot. They've got quicker to the point. I mean, it's something like. This isn't available in tubeless yet, but Vittoria's Corsa All Seasons one, I can't remember the exact name of it. That's one of the, you know, the swiftest tyres I've used in a long, long time. Just feels beautiful. That's got the graphene compound in it. So, you know, the rubber seems to stretch and mould in corners fabulously well, but it's a really tough tyre with it, you know. So they have come on a lot. But I think when you're looking at things like the Marathon, that's more of a traditional kind of touring tyre. So that's built to do, you know, thousands of miles and, you know, but not at speed, as it were. So I think as long as you go for a brand's racier option with protection rather than, you know, their more commuting or touring focused tyres, you know, you will find some good ones out there.
And do you think these protections, you know, are very advantageous? Do they work really well, or is it a bit marginal as to whether it's worth it? Or,
I mean, it's really hard to judge. You know, I think if you're looking for a tyre for a lot of longevity, then anything where the compound's got cut protection is well worth having. You know, especially on like weeks like this week in the UK, where we've had a really, really hot week, so all the roads have baked dry, and then you get rain. And all that rain just brings up those little sharps and flints to the surface. So you'll go out and ride, you'll come back and, you know, a really nice, soft, racy tyre, you'll come back and you'll find it's got cuts and splits all over it. You know, nothing yet critical, but it only needs that little, you know, that little deeper cut to actually, you know, almost write a tyre off, really. And when you're talking at the minute, you know, a road tyre can be anything from, you know, up to 75, 80 quid each. You know, that's a serious dent in your pocket.
Yeah. You mentioned the Vittoria graphene compound. What's that all about?
Well, they've used a graphene layer within the rubber on the surface. And, you know, graphene is like this sort of super light wonder material that's incredibly strong. And it has this really weird effect on those tyres that when you're not loading the tyre sideways, you're just riding straight in a straight line, they feel incredibly quick. They make a weird noise, to be honest. They almost buzz along the road. But then when you go into a corner, because of the quality of the graphene weave within the rubber, they seem to stretch. You know, they seem to sort of spread. So you get this insane amount of grip in corners. You know, you can really, really push the limits of what's effectively a slick tyre. And, you know, I've been running a set of courses on one of my own bikes now since they launched, which is like over 2 years, and they're still good. You know, they seem to wear very, very evenly. So you don't get bald spots. You get even wear throughout the tyre. You know, and I've probably put probably best part of 1,300, 1,400 miles into those tyres. And they're still going. You know, they're getting thin, but they're not on the casing yet. There's still rubber there. You know, it seems to be a smart implementation of some, you know, interesting tech that's gone into those tyres.
Wicked. Okay, well, sticking with tyres, Rob, someone's asking what is the best all-round mountain bike tyre for year-long use? And this is a bit of a potentially contentious one, and maybe depends a little bit on what you're riding, but, you know, someone who rides maybe slightly more aggressive bikes, longer travel stuff, what do you run, sort of, what would you run year-round if you could?
Okay, so, yeah, like you said, it is a really tricky one, and tyres, I think there's so much choice out there now, it is very much down to sort of personal preference to a degree. And then things like rim width and the terrain you're riding on, obviously, is another big factor to take into account. But in terms of, if we're going purely just down the route of looking at tyre treads, I guess for me, I generally tend to run the same front and rear. I don't tend to go for a faster rolling rear tyre. As we're talking about just keeping a set of tyres on for the year, bearing in mind, you know, maybe in the summer I might stick a slightly faster rolling tyre on. But for the most part, when I'm slowing down riding steep stuff, I want to be able to, you know, use the back tyre and grip as much as I can as well. I know I'll probably get slammed for saying that, but, you know, I like slowing down. I get too scared.
You like your grip, do you? Yeah.
I like my grip, yeah. So, yeah, generally I would go for something nice and predictable like the Maxxis High Roller 2s. I'm still a big fan of those. They've been around for a long time now. Or the Minion DHR 2s. And generally, I run... So I've got some high rollers on one bike, actually, both in double-down casing. I know you could probably go lighter on the front, but I guess I'm at a point where I just... If I'm riding, say, my own bike, the last thing I want to do is have to faff and stress about puncturing tyres and all that. I'm not too worried about overall weight. And the double down casing's pretty much spot on for most of the stuff I do. It's, you know, those have survived a lot of laps at Bike Park Wales, which is really rough. Well, some trails there are really rough. Equally, I've spent a lot of time on the new Assegai tyre. from Maxxis as well, which is another good one, in the XO Plus casing. So I use that on the front, which is a good choice. But yeah, for me, something like the High Roller 2s, maybe in Max Grip on the front and Max Terra on the back, that 3C compound, I'd say is a good sort of year-round tread. It seems to shed mud well enough, and there's enough bite in there when it does get soft. They're not going to work as well as a sort of, you know, like a full-on spike, or maybe something like a Magic Mary, which has taller, squarer tread blocks. But I think they're a good compromise when it comes to, you know, rolling resistance and things like that. So across the span of a year in a multitude of conditions, that's probably what I'd go for. Mm-hmm. Nice and predictable, consistent, really good shape to them. I feel like I always know where I'm at with those tires. When I get back on a bike with those, I feel really confident and really happy.
Yeah. Did you say you're running a Minion DHR2 on the front of a bike as well?
I run them on both front and rear.
Front and rear. And obviously, like, the DHR stands for, well, DH rear, because it have a DHF as well. So what's the advantage of running that rear tire on the front?
Well, because Maxxis offer it in so many different compounds, it seems like, you know, I'm not being penalized because I can still get a soft enough front tire. So it's not, I think there are some brands which will offer certain tires. I think WTB only do the Judge. I could be wrong, but when they launched the Judge, which is their sort of what they say is their rear, you know, rear specific tire, it only came in their fast rolling compound.
Mm-hmm.
Maxxis offer pretty much every tire in a multitude of different compounds. So it, you know, it's a good tire on the rear, and it's still a really good tire on the front.
Okay.
It seems to work well for me anyway. Yeah.
We're good. Okay. So Warren, we're going to go back to Curly Bars, and someone's asking what the real difference is between a cross bike and a gravel bike. Surely they're the same thing, a road bike with knobbly tires. And obviously on the face of it, they do look very similar. But would you say that there's much difference, or what is the difference?
Yeah, well, yeah, they may look very similar, especially in some cases of your more racier gravel bikes. You know, think of something like the new Cervelo, you know, Orbea's Terra. But then, you know, gravel bikes are a really diverse breed. But I'd say, you know, general rule, a cross bike will have more aggressive geometry. It'll be a bit steeper in both head and seat angles. You know, these are bikes that are designed to be raced for an hour, you know, at most. Mm-hmm. Whereas a gravel bike needs to be comfortable enough to be ridden all day or longer. You know, if you think about gravel events, they tend to be, you know, epic distances in the main. Cross bikes traditionally have a higher bottom bracket. You know, that's a carryover from, you know, days of yore when bikes ran toe clips rather than clipless pedals. You know, you needed the ground clearance. And weirdly, that just still persists. I guess it's something that everybody's just got used to. And also, you know, if you think about cross racing, the UCI restricts tire size in cross races to 33 millimeters wide. Most gravel bikes mm-hmm. can go much, much bigger than, you know, entire width than that. And you're also more likely to find on a cross bike that the top tube is much more horizontal. You know, it's less sloping, it's less like mountain bike styled. And that's the simple reason, you know, cross racers need to be able to shoulder the bike. They need to be able to carry it and run with it at some point. But then also, you know, gravel bikes tend to be more versatile. You'll get rack, guard / fender mounts and multiple bottom mounts. And not to mention, you know, dual wheel size compatibility. All things that a cross bike that's intended to be racing, therefore it needs to be light, they just tend to do away with, you know. So, yeah, you know, ostensibly they may look similar, but actually, you know, the differences can be vast.
Okay, so I guess if you were going to go and buy one now, you know, maybe have a think. If you're going to race, obviously get a cross bike, but if you're probably just looking for some, you know, dirt tracks, that sort of thing, maybe it would be worth jumping on this gravelly bandwagon and going with a dedicated gravel bike.
Yeah, or it depends on, you know, what sort of riding you intend to do. You know, if you're going out for a quick couple of hours blast, you know, down some trails, you know, with your mates, or hitting byways and bridleways, then you might not ever need the ability to, you know, carry your house on your back sort of thing. So one of the lighter, racier gravel options, you know, I'm thinking, you know, like the Cervelo, like Cannondale Topstone, you know, that sort of thing. Where they've more come from a race end of the spectrum, you know, as opposed to say something from, you know, Surly or you know, one of the Genesis style bikes where you've got every fixture and fitting you could ever want. You know, if you're never ever going to go bikepacking, why, you know, you don't necessarily need all the accoutrements that a bike comes with for that. So it's more just decide on what you want to do.
All right. Well, speaking of deciding what you want to go and do, Rob, should I get a hardtail or a full suspension bike at £1,000? Obviously, £1,000 bike to work scheme sort of price, also like a really good entry point into mountain biking. And there's some great options kind of for both at that price point, just about, isn't there?
Yeah. I would say it's worth really thinking about what sort of stuff you want to ride. Because if you are looking to use that bike, and you know, if it's part of the cycle to work scheme, maybe you are looking to commute a bit on it as well. And at which point, you know, things like, well, kind of like Woz has already mentioned, you know, rack mounts, things like that are really useful if you're going to be carrying your stuff to work. And they're things that you generally won't find on a full suspension bike. Obviously, when you compare the two, you're generally going to get, I guess, a bit more bang for your buck on a hardtail when it comes to the spec, because obviously money isn't going into that full suspension design, the rear shock, you know, the complexities that come with that. So instead, you'd get a frame and you're going to hopefully get some pretty decent stuff on there, including hopefully a relatively decent suspension fork at that price. That's not to say that there aren't good full sus bikes, because obviously with the likes of Calibre, I mean, I know Guy Outdoors is going through some issues at the moment, and fingers crossed that brand will survive. But, you know, the likes of the Bossnut really helped turn around that part of the market, I think, offering a really solid spec on a frame that genuinely worked well. You know, I think it was a long time ago where if you were to go down that route and buy, you know, £1,000 full suspension bike, the geometry was going to be fairly traditional. It was going to be quite limiting. And as soon as you got on the trail, the specs were generally pretty poor. They were almost like place fillers for some brands. Whereas I think now it's a, you know, those bikes can genuinely compete with bikes that are, you know, almost twice their price, which is seriously impressive. But again, I think it's all about thinking about the sort of stuff you want to ride. And also taking into account things like, if you're not too handy when it comes to maintenance, a full suspension bike will generally, because there's more moving parts on it, cause more issues. So you're going to generally have to spend more time tinkering, fixing, maintaining it. So if you're riding it, you know, if you're not using it to ride to work on, and it's generally just, you know, you want to go and ride trail centers and mess around in the woods, a really good hardtail with more progressive geometry will be able to do the job. But you're certainly going to reach a point where I think, you know, especially if you're riding with your mates who all have full suspension bikes, where maybe you're going to want a full suspension bike. So again, it's all about, you know, weighing up what's available and what you can do on it. I think another thing to take into account at that price point is, and I think Seb brought it up in a recent bike test, in fact, was due to the fact that they're spending so much money, or those bikes, you know, they'll try and spend the money where it really counts on the specs of the fork, the brakes, the drivetrain, stuff like that. It might be then that the brands are unable to offer, you know, five sizes, for example, which, so it's all good and well having your heart set on a certain bike. I think it's actually been Carrera,
wasn't it? Titan X.
Yeah, I think there's that, and I think one of the Calibers, I think maybe the Line 10 is limited. I could be wrong on that bike, but I think it's, you know, those bikes are maybe only available in two size options. So it's great if you're, you know, someone like maybe me or you that kind of can fit on either. But at the, you know, the shorter or the taller end of the spectrum, you might be seriously limited. So I would say best thing to do is get into your local bike shop, have a sit on the bikes, make sure you're comfortable on the sizes first and foremost, and that they offer something for you, and really weigh up what it is you want to do. A full mm-hmm. suspension bike is going to open up more in terms of what it's capable of. So, you know, a wider variety of terrain. That's not to say you couldn't do it on a hardtail. You might just have less fun doing it on a hardtail.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, I guess.
It's subjective, isn't it?
Of course it is. And I know there's people out there that absolutely, you know, diehard hardtail fans that won't ride anything else. And they're incredible riders and can do things that, you know, I could only dream of. Equally, you know, I'm getting old. I want a bit of comfort. And knowing that I can ride a full suspension bike and I could, you know, get offline a little bit, you know, for me, that would be a, you know, a bit of a saving grace. Probably, though, £1,000, I would probably go down the hardtail route just to know that I'd, you know, maybe get a more solid spec. And some of those bikes, you know, Saracen have got some great bikes with their long, low slack geometry.
Yeah.
And they're really worth considering, I think.
Wicked. Okay. This is one I sort of find quite an interesting question, Warren, actually. I've got a gravel bike on its way soon, which has got a, it's a SRAM's ETAP group set, but it's got one of the XO1 mountain bike rear mechs and a 10 to 50 tooth Eagle cassette. But if you go to the Shimano side of things, how wide a range can you go with Shimano's DI2 with a single ring? And can they use a mountain bike cassette and maybe mech to get that, to get a wider range on the back? And obviously, like the cable stuff is up to a 10 to 51 on the mountain bike with cables. Is what's the cross compatibility between, you know, the mountain and the road stuff from Shimano?
I guess, you know, it bears kind of understanding DI2, you know, as a range across Shimano's road systems, because effectively not all the DI2 systems are equal.
Right.
So if you take Durace, you know, it's the premium, it's aimed at pro level riders. Now, Durace is designed with a maximum cassette capacity of an 1130. But then when you move down to Ortega DI2, Shimano haven't just made that a cheaper version of Durace anymore. It's now much more broad in its appeal. So you can go up to an 1134 on Ortega. And then also there's the little outlier of the Ortega RX DI2 mech, which is completely compatible across the board, but it comes with a clutch. You know, borrow from mountain bike, which is an essential if you're going to go to a single ring setup. Now, of course, we also have Shimano GRX. This is their gravel stroke adventure specific group. Also has that clutch mech, and it has an increased capacity. It can go up to an 1142. If you want to go bigger than that, yeah, you can switch in an XT or an XTR rear mech. It has to be 11 speed, obviously. And you can mix road shifters with off-road rear mechs, but you can't mix derailleurs, weirdly. So you can't have a road front mech with a mountain bike rear mech. They won't work. And so if you did go down that route of sticking a mountain bike mech on the back, you can go up to an 1146. So you can't, at the minute, go to a massive, like, 1051, you know, as with, you know, Shimano's latest, which you guys will know much more than me about. So 1146, I think, which should be ample, you know. You know, I've got a GRX DI2 bike that I've been running, you know, sort of long term now. That's GRX one by, and I've just gone for the 1142. I haven't got up to 1146 yet, and I found 1142 is pretty much, you know, I haven't got anywhere, you know, or climbed anything yet where I thought, oh, I really need a lot of gear. So I mean, I you know, you guys know more about the mountain bike side of DO2 than I do. I don't know if 1140, you know, Shimano can usually be quite conservative on gear range, so I don't know if there's any aftermarket cassettes that you can push that 1146 limit any, or
Rob, any ideas on that?
It's hard to say. Yeah, so I mean, using a mountain bike rear mech, there's a lot of options out there from the likes of E13, Hope offer cassettes as well with a varying range. Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm more in agreement with what Warren's saying in that I'm not sure you'd need to go too much bigger. Mm-hmm. I think on the off-road side, just because the climbs are that bit slower and more technical and you've got more obstacles to try and overcome on the hills, then yeah, you know, being able to drop into, you know, for example, the new 1052 that SRAM are offering. Mm. I must admit, I wondered if it was absolutely necessary when it first came out. And I was lucky enough to get the cassette ahead of the launch, and I've ridden it quite a lot, and I've used the 52 tooth quite a fair bit. So I think, yeah, I guess it's one of those things, isn't it? If you're struggling right now, there are options out there. I can't say how easily compatible they'll be, and yeah, some of them as well obviously will use different driver bodies and stuff like that, so you've got to be really careful with not just whether it'll fit or not, but whether it's going to safely work with the mech, cause any other potential issues. Mm-hmm. I think on the mountain bike side, we're probably I guess more willing to have something kind of grumble along and maybe not sound quite so precise. But on the road, it feels like anytime I ride a road bike and things aren't quite right, indexing's a little bit out or anything like that, it absolutely does my head in. Mm. So, you know, I would go for, you know, try and make it as compatible as possible. That would be obviously the key. And I'd maybe limit it. And yeah, like Woz says, you know, and stick with the 46 for now.
Yeah. Do you know, Woz, if on the cable side of things, the XTR or XT, or well, actually it's all the way down to Dior now with the super wide range 12-speed stuff. Does that work with Shimano's 12-speed mechanical shifters, do you know?
Shimano on the road hasn't gone to 12-speed yet, so...
So probably not.
I mean, you know, if we switch over to the other side, over to SRAM, I mean, last week I did a lot of miles on a gravel bike with a kind of mullet built, so it's got an XO rear and a Force front. So I was riding around with like a 1050 on the back, and to be honest, it expanded the horizons of what a gravel bike can do. You know, I was looking at little bits of trail where I thought, oh, that'd be kind of fun on a mountain bike. And I was suddenly thinking, oh, I can do it on this. You know, I can try and ride up that on this. And it, you know, it was almost like it was like riding a sort of, well, an old school, very, very lightweight XC bike with drop bars. So, I was blown away by it, to be honest. It was brilliant.
Like John Tomac from the 90s.
Exactly, yeah. I just need a skin suit and a Tioga disc drive. I'm away.
Well, don't go out in the wind.
we'll go back to a mountain bike question very quickly, which maybe at some point in the future will have a bit relevance to gravel riders as well, but... Weeds, very quickly, how do you care for your suspension in between services? So we're not talking those 40-50 hour service intervals, but on a day-to-day ride-to-ride basis.
Okay, I would start by saying, especially in the UK, no matter what, we're always going to be washing our bikes. Sadly, we don't really have much choice. So first, I would just say, be really mindful of where you're pointing the hose and how powerful it is. So avoid, you know, spraying the seals directly, because water will penetrate, it will get in there, and it will obviously over time cause damage and issues with performance and stuff like that. That'd be my first point. Next one would be keep the seals as clean as possible. So, you know, using a clean cloth, it could be anything from like, you know, an old t-shirt, whatever it might be, as long as it's clean, and just getting in there, getting inside and around the fork arch and just giving it a clean out. Don't let that sort of that gunky buildup get in there, because while it might not look like it's anything too problematic, it could be that, you know, if it does become a bit gunky and sticky, you're going to get more dirt particles sticking to it, which over time will slowly, if you don't clean your bike at all, start to score the stanchions. And that's going to just cause more issues with, you know, keeping everything where it needs to be. You know, you're going to, if you start to score the stanchions, you might start affecting how good the seals are at sealing. And so more stuff is going to get inside, which is obviously a problem. So, yeah, it's just a case of keeping an eye on those. You can use stuff, certain brands, certain lubrication brands will offer, you know, dedicated suspension lubes.
So like a Teflon spray type thing?
Yeah, normally like a sort of silicon style spray.
Okay.
And so what the first thing I'd say with that is if you're going to use it, because it's a spray and it could potentially go anywhere, and if you're doing it outside and the wind blows it, cover your disc rotors up first.
Mm.
So use something clean, whether that's carrier bags, wrapped around tapes, whatever it might be. So keep your rotors covered and your calipers as well. And then you can just apply this sort of lube around the seals. Then you need to cycle the fork or the shock through a few times. And hopefully you should see any of the gunk or that's built up sort of around the lip or slightly just underneath it will hopefully come to the surface once that lube sort of penetrated in there. Then you just give that a clean off and then give it another quick coating. It doesn't need to be overboard, just enough, and then wipe off any excess. That should help, you know, to keep things running quite smoothly, and it should, you know, prevent the seals getting too dry and cracked and stuff like that. Not that that's generally a problem in the UK. If you're handier on the tools, I would say it's worth always, you know, whipping your lower legs off just for a lower leg service. But if you're going to do that, you need to check on the manufacturer's website to ensure that, you know, you've got the right parts. If you're going to do, you know, for example, lube the foam rings or swap the foam rings or swap the wiper seals and all that, make sure you purchase that kit beforehand and you know that it fits before you, you know, you do a Friday night, take it apart and then can't get it back together and ruin your Saturday morning ride. And also make sure you've got the right tools for the job, because where I think we're all probably guilty of, you know, maybe not using the right things from time to time when working on our bikes. When it comes to your suspension, I don't think it's worth cutting those corners, because you can cause, you know, irreversible damage that's really expensive. So making sure you've got the right parts is essential, and the right tool, sorry. And obviously, if you don't feel confident enough and something does feel a little bit wrong, just get in touch with one of the suspension tuning companies. There's loads of really good ones out there. They offer a really good service, really fast turnaround, and they might even be able to recommend some setup tips and stuff like that for you. And they and it doesn't cost a fortune, and it does have a huge effect on performance. Yeah.
I guess if you've been riding a fork or a shock for quite a while and doing a little bit, you know, keeping it clean and stuff, but not having had it serviced, you know, when you send it off and then get it back, it makes a world of difference. It's that sort of gradual degradation in performance that you don't really notice from ride to ride, and then you get it back from a service and they can feel incredible.
Exactly. And you know, and it might be that if it's a year or two old, it might be that those suspension tuning companies have, you know, potentially have upgrade kits as well, you know, that are included in the price, and or maybe just a small add-on.
Mm-hmm.
So you can, you know, really transform it, like you said, and it does make a big difference. But for the day-to-day stuff, I think the key is just keeping on it, keep it clean, keep everything nice and clean, lubed where you can, and ensure, you know, you're always looking out for any marks on the shock shaft or the fork stanchions, you know, because that will lead to the bigger problems down the line.
Okay, then I think we'll finish on two very quick sort of setup geometry sort of questions. So on the roadside, so I've got a guy who's new to riding on the road, and while my current bike feels pretty comfy, I'm still not sure it's spot on for me. Someone mentioned it might be worth playing with stem length. How do I decide what stem length is right for me, Warren?
Well, the old roadie rule, that is, if you're sat on your bike, your hands on the hoods, and you look down at the front hub, the bar should completely obscure your hub, basically. You know, most of us just stick with what the bike came with, but there are plenty of variables out there in not just stem length, but also like angle. You know, if you think most road bikes have a 73 degree head angle, if you took that to an extreme and got mm-hmm. a stem with a minus 17 on it, then that stem would sit absolutely parallel to the ground. But most stems can be flipped. So if you prefer a little bit more of an upright position, you can flip the stem and have it slightly pointing upwards. You know, they're normally around minus or plus 6 degrees. But stem length, really, aside from the fit issues, it's really going to affect the way the bike handles. If you think of long stem, that effectively gives you a longer steering arm. So it makes your bike feel less responsive, less twitchy. It's really good at speed. It mm-hmm. makes it really nice and stable. You know, if you think of like a steering wheel on a truck, that's the sort of thing we're aiming for. Whereas you went to a shorter stem, you're shortening that steering arm, which makes it much more responsive to steering inputs. But that can be detrimental, making the bike feel stable at speed. You know, if you think of like the steering wheel on a Formula One car, you know, it's that sort of thing. So big chart, you know, big part of stem choice is really personal preference on mm-hmm. how you like a bike to feel. But what I would say is don't go too short as you feel cramped, you know, that your arms are totally bent with your elbows sitting alongside your trunk, as it were. And don't go so overlong that you're overextending, so you find it hard to actually control the bike. Without going and getting a proper fit, it's a very difficult thing to judge it autonomically. You just more have to go on the way it feels. But I'd say if our guy posing the question says it feels comfy, then maybe it's handling he wants to slightly tune.
Would you suggest maybe if this person is looking to, you know, really get into road cycling in a big way, and maybe this is the first bike, but there'll be bikes down the line, do you think it would be worth investing in a bike fit?
Oh, I think so, definitely. You know, it doesn't really matter how long you've been riding. I'd always recommend a bike fit. It's just good to have, you know, but what I would say is whenever you go for a bike fit, don't make it a one-way conversation. Because you can get a thing where you just get the bike fitter's particular preference. We'll try mm-hmm. and impart on you. You know, he might be a time trialist and go, right, we want to get you as fast in this aero as possible. And you go, but, I only go for Sunday runs with my mates to the pub. It's got to be a two-way conversation. And the other thing you have to, remember is bike fits are a good regular thing for any serious cyclist, because as you get older, you change. You get less flexible, mm-hmm. you know. You might be getting more knee problems. You might, you know, there are all these things. Or conversely, you know, as you get more into cycling, you might get fitter. You might have lost some weight. You might have got more flexibility. You know, so it's always good just to have a, you know, a reassessment, as it were.
Okay. Do you know roughly how much a bike fit costs?
Oh, they tend to vary, and you know there are a lot of brands now. When you're moving into that higher bracket of bike, that almost build it into the process. You know, especially, okay. you know, as we're seeing, a lot of brands are going to a more kind of semi-custom kind of thing. You know, if you think of someone like Specialized, when you're looking at like their S-Works bikes, they positively encourage you to go and get fitted for a bike, especially now mm-hmm. when you're getting bikes that have got far much more integration. You know, if you've got a fully integrated, you know, internal cable routing system, so it's vital that things like the steering length is cut perfectly. You know, they tend to want to get you in and get you on a jig and see how to set it up. Because the worst thing that can happen is, you know, you end up buying a bike that's far too slam for you. It's completely uncomfortable. And you just end up having to get shot of it, you know.
Cool. Okay, so maybe, worth having a play around and maybe think about getting a bike fit then.
Yeah, I think bike fit, you know, generally you're probably looking at about £100 for a pretty comprehensive one.
Yeah. You know? Well, you know, spending hours on a bike might be worth that investment.
Yeah.
Okay, and speaking of bike fits, Rob, is there a trick for working out your mountain bike bar width? So, you know, you buy a wide bar, 800mm, people chop them down. How do you work out how far to chop it if you want to?
Okay, this is, so when you said it's a really short answer,
okay.
Sorry. Well, so I would say... you can cut, you know, if you ride regularly and you're fairly experienced and you know what works for you, obviously that's a good starting point. But if you've just bought a new bar and you use lock-on grips that you're able to, so normally the ones with a lock-on either end, so they don't have a enclosed mm-hmm. bar end cap, essentially, you can slide those grips in.
Yeah.
So you could measure in, you know, slide them in and slowly in, you know, 5 mil increments, work those grips out until you sort of feel comfy. You just need to bear in mind that you've got, you know, massive bits of uncut bar mm-hmm. either end, potentially ready to slam into the tree or kebab you if it all goes wrong. I know a lot of people go by getting into the presser mm-hmm. position and seeing where their hands comfortably feel. Rough, you know, sort of going roughly by that, whereby you don't feel that you're overstretched and doing the push-ups really hard. Because, you know, you think about when you're riding the bike and you are pushing against the bars a lot, you know, when you're going through undulations and stuff like that, that's essentially what you're doing. It is, you know, obviously it's a more complex movement on the bike, but more or less it's a kind of push-up, right? So getting into that press-up position and seeing where your hands feel comfortable, roughly what width, and then taking that and transferring it onto the bike. Then there have, of course, our good friend and colleague, Seb Stott, has worked out a way you can roughly calculate this. So you take your height in centimetres, you multiply it by 4.25, and it should give you your bar width in millimetres. Although saying that, I did that, and it actually came up. It actually came up 731 mil. And I normally ride, I must admit, I normally ride 760 pretty much for everything. Because I haven't got particularly wide shoulders, I don't need a super wide bar. I felt, and I played with bar width quite a lot, and I think I only went up to the slightly wider bars when I started riding 29ers mm-hmm. more back in 2013, 2014. I went from 750 to 760 just because I felt like the bigger wheel needed a bit more mm-hmm. oomph, a bit more leverage to get it turned. And I made that switch and it was a positive change. I might play around with it again. I listened to a different podcast where they were interviewing an enduro racer, and it's quite funny how narrow those guys are going with bars, just so they can, well, if you think the speeds they're riding those trails, trying to thread between trees, you know, going so fast, and I don't think any of the top guys are on anything like an 800 mile bar. You know, Richie Rude's running, I think 740 right. 750, and he's a big guy. So I think it might be something that I revisit mm-hmm. down the line. But yeah, generally speaking, go too wide and you're going to be, you know, you're going to affect how you can ride the bike. As soon as you start to stretch your arms out so far that, you know, you're effectively not able to then absorb the bumps and the jumps quite so well with your arms because they're straighter rather than being more flexed, then it is going to have a detrimental effect, you know, and too narrow. Providing you're running the same short stem, is going to make things feel really twitchy and harder to control. So, you know, as with anything, if you can play around with the widths, you know, as we said at the beginning of this answer, you know, move your grips in, have a feel, have a play, and go from there. But check it before, you know, obviously it's always measure twice, cut once, mm-hmm. that sort of, that old analogy, you've got to stick to that, because, you know, handlebars, if you go out and buy, say, 100 quid, you know, carbon handlebars and end up chopping them down way too much or uneven, even worse, then, you know, you can't just take that bar back on, unfortunately.
Totally. Okay. We'll go on, Mark.
Has anybody ever looked into the effect of bar width and aerodynamics? Because surely if you're running like a super wide bar, you're spreading your arms wide, you're just almost creating a sail kind of sort of thing, you know.
I guess it's that sort of, I'm sure they are. I'm sure people have had a look at it. I don't know how much is in the public domain with regards to that. I'm sure it is totally relevant. I guess it's a case of balancing how much that'll affect your aeroness, your aero shape, and how negative that could impact on your overall time if you're racing versus how in control you feel. But I mean, if you've got the top guys at EWS running, you know, when you think about how many bars are sold at 800 mil now, and then you stick some grips on, which might, you know, actually not run all the way to the ends of bars, might stick out. So you're making the bar 810, maybe even more. And how many people are just willing to just leave them as they are and run them just like that? It is kind of worrying. So I think it's a really important thing to play around with, not necessarily to make you more aero, but just to give you the right amount of control, ensure that you're in the right position on the bike, that your arms can effectively, you know, work as part of the suspension to absorb the trail. So I think if the top guys can run super narrow bars, it's a trend maybe we need to move away from. And I think, I remember back in the day, everyone just assumed that, you know, people like Sam Hill were running these massive, massive bars. And the reality was they were cutting them down straight away. It was only the likes of, you know, Greg and Steve who needed, at that point, Greg, Steve and Nathan Rennie were running extenders in their bars to make them a bit wider. So if you're really tall, it makes total sense. But, you know, I think for the majority of people, you know, you need to play around and get it right if you want to make the most of the bike and the handling.
Totally. Okay. Well, thank you for that. And I think we'll wrap it up there. We've got a big meeting in about 12 minutes, so we're going to make a run for it. Thank you for your time, Rob.
No worries. Thank you,
and,
Tom.
And thank you, Warren, for that. It's some really interesting stuff today, I think.
Cheers. Thanks, Tom. That was interesting. I enjoyed that.
Excellent. Well, if you have enjoyed it, which we hope you have, don't forget to subscribe to the Bike Radar podcast. We're doing podcasts every Monday and every Friday, so plenty to get your ears around. And we'll do another one of these Q&As in about 4 weeks' time. So thank you very much, and have a good day. Thank you for listening to the Bike Radar podcast. If you want any more information on what we've been talking about or more news and views on cycling, check out bikeradar.com.